for the one who is going to satisfy the needs of people is to pay in a way that you not be, you know, known person. You have to be unknown when you pay. It's the best way of paying. For that reason, what we have in the tradition of Imams, they did that action over the, you know, nights and over the hours that nobody, you know, knew them or understand that these are Imams. You have to pay unknowingly. And sometimes people used to come to the door of Imam al-Hussein asking something. And once Imam saw that a person, you know, looking at the face of Imam al-Hussein and asking needs, and he said, "Do not ask me directly like this." Because Imam saw that he's violating his honor in this way. "Please write your needs down so that I can read and give you something." Because of, you know, protecting his honor, he's saying it's better to write it down instead of saying directly. "Do not ask me face to face. Rather write it down. It's better for you." اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. And in the other occasion, it is a very famous story. One needy person came to the door of Imam, and Imam hided himself behind the door and just handed something to the needy person without showing himself. Because he was thinking about the honor and the personality of that person, not to be violated in this way. If you are a generous person, it's better to pay and to give only for the sake of God, not for the sake of yourself. To be unknown, not to be known. It's better to pay through some people with the mediation, not you yourself directly. It is the best, you know, generosity that Imam practiced that. And Imam practiced generosity in all his life. And the best and the perfect generosity Imam did was on the day of Ashura in the Battle of Karbala. He gave all he had for the sake of God. His life, his companions' lives, his relatives' lives, the dignity of his family. So all of them are given for the sake of God. So nothing remained for Hussein at that time. This is the perfect generosity that the one can see in history. Imam did that. Then Allah is going to compensate that action Imam did. What Allah did, you know, before that action Imam did for the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. These are very, very interesting things that I don't want to take your time more, but these are something done by God, you know, in front of Imam al-Hussein's martyrdom. First, after martyrdom, Imam al-Hussein became Thar Allah, the one whose revenge or revenger is Allah himself. Allah took the responsibility of his revenge for himself, by himself. "I am the revenger of al-Hussein because of his martyrdom, not anybody else." So he is the Thar Allah. This is one thing. The other way Allah compensated that In different occasions, he encouraged people through prophets and imams to go to visit Imam al-Hussein's grave. In every occasion he mentioned, even in the night of Qadr, in which Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam was martyred, in that night we do have visitation of Imam al-Hussein. In every feast days, holy days of Islam, it is mentioned it's better to go to visit Imam al-Hussein. If you cannot go to the near, you know, visitation, then it is enough ziyarah from distance. Stay here, stay whatever you are, you live, and just face yourself and your face toward Karbala by saying, As-salamu alayka, ya Aba Abdullah al-Hussein. So this is visitation.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Imam al-Hussein is the most generous Imam, and we can ask our needs. We can talk about our difficulties today, and inshallah he will give us much more than our needs. Oh Allah, for the sake of this Imam, please forgive our sins and please put us among real Shia of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and among the helpers of Imam al-Mahdi. أجل الله تعالى فرجك الشريف والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Prosperous is he,
prosperous is he,
who spends his wealth on the poor and needy, who speaks a kind word to kin and neighbor, ever grateful for Allah's favor. Guided is he,
guided is he,
who prays Salah with punctuality. Early morning tahajjud he prays, for Allah's pleasure and nearness he craves. Blessed is he,
blessed is he,
who sings Allah's praises fervently. Blessed be all of Allah's slaves. Allah's mercy be with them always. Fortunate is he,
fortunate is he,
who remembers Allah abundantly. Worldly distractions cannot mildly sway his thoughts of Allah and judgment day.
Saudi Arabia, located between the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. The discovery of oil in 1938 under the Arabian sands was a godsend that turned the desert kingdom into a modern, affluent state. Yet in recent years, with the emergence of industries based on renewable resources and wild oscillations in the value of oil, the future of oil as black gold, as well as the future of the world's largest oil exporter, have been thrown into question. Therefore, the young princes of Saudi Arabia, who hope to rule over the country for decades to come, have a strong, urgent sense of vocation to wean the kingdom off oil revenues before it is too late. But the mission, dubbed Vision 2030, has turned out to be an uphill battle, and the Saudis have to fight on various fronts.
العرب. الحادث اللي حدث مؤلم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
While the coronavirus pandemic and ensuing low prices have hit the Saudi kingdom's economy hard as unexpected crises, the Saudis have realized that they can no longer rely on oil. Once a supplier of nearly 30% of the global oil market, the kingdom is now providing the market with just 12%. But the main question is what the Saudis have for relying on except for oil. The immediate answer is tourism. As one of the pillars of Vision 2030, tourism is hoped to draw 100 million visitors a year to Saudi Arabia by the end of the decade. The number of visitors was about 15 million in 2018, so the goal seems to be too ambitious. Meanwhile, the severity of the pandemic has caused many countries depending on tourism to reconsider their main sources of income. Over the last year, the kingdom lost a huge amount of money to the pandemic, as it had to restrict the annual Hajj to mere 1,000 domestic pilgrims.
I think that's simply delusional. Several reasons. First of all, the last place you want to go to on the planet when we're experiencing global warming is a place which was hot without it. The idea that people would want to go to Saudi Arabia voluntarily is, I think, absurd. Unless they could offer something which is just ludicrously unlike what Saudi Arabia currently is. And in general, tourism may never recover after COVID. We've already seen it decimated by the impact of the virus on international travel. And with that combined with global warming, there may be no real tourism industry globally at all by 2030. So the thought that Saudi Arabia thinks it can have a booming economy courtesy of tourism there, I think is probably even more delusional than thinking they can get themselves off oil successfully by 2030 as well.
Apart from the pandemic, Saudi Arabia has to gain a more benign reputation before being able to attract visitors from across the world. A country where women are still mistreated as the weaker sex, children are executed, and activists and journalists are behind bars or killed, will have a difficult job to attract millions of tourists.
Saudi Arabia's record on human rights is appalling, and this is something which they could get away with when they had enormous wealth from oil. It's one reason Donald Trump turned up there to salivate at the prospect of trade deals with Saudi Arabia. But when the oil price collapses, you simply can't get away with things like arranging extrajudicial assassinations, with putting people in jail, women in jail because they campaigned for the right to drive automobiles. All this sort of stuff you can paper over with large amounts of money. If the money's not there anymore, then that's what stands out rather than the cash flow.
Meanwhile, the Saudi kingdom is under pressure to create enough jobs for its young population. Over the past three decades, the kingdom's population has doubled. Almost two-thirds of it are under 30, and most of them are unemployed university graduates. According to Vision 2030, the kingdom needs to create 400,000 new jobs each year. That's going to happen under the Saudization plan, meaning to expel expat employees. But experts say it's neither financially nor technically feasible. On the one hand, the kingdom has to pay higher wages to local workers in comparison to workers hailing from poor Asian and African countries, which puts a further burden on the already failing economy. On the other hand, Saudi Arabia still needs high-level technicians coming from abroad, as its younger generation is not skillful enough to run the vital parts of the industry.
Well, I haven't been to Saudi Arabia, but I have been to other countries in the Middle East where the vast majority of the labor were expats, often from other Arabian countries, working in those countries for high wages compared to their home country, but of course far less than the wages that Saudis themselves would be willing to work for or nationals of wealthy oil Arabian countries would be willing to work for. So the very thought that people who are currently living effectively on largesse from the surplus generated from the oil revenue would be willing to work at wages that are far below the level of living they're currently getting just strikes me as laughable. And I can see quite strong revolts by the youth of Saudi Arabia if they find this is the fate they face.
At the same time, the standards of living are declining in the kingdom. To the dismay of Saudi citizens, VAT, or value-added tax, was introduced for the first time in 2018 and trebled in 2020. To worsen the situation for the citizens, Riyadh has reduced fuel subsidies and scrapped a cost-of-living allowance. Vehicle sales over the past 5 years can serve as a barometer of tumbling standards of living in Saudi Arabia. A report by the World Bank in 2020 shows 800,000 cars were sold in 2015, 400,000 in 2018, and 300,000 in 2020. The alarm was sounded for the Saudi economy in 2014 when the state spending and royal extravagance outpaced revenues, and therefore the Saudis were forced to turn to the international markets. It is estimated that by the end of 2021, the kingdom's debts will add up to 50% of its GDP.
Generally speaking, it's Saudi Arabia. If any country on the planet was dependent upon the oil age, it was Saudi Arabia. And with the oil age ending quite possibly this next couple of years, then so is its economic fortune. It reminds me to some extent of Nauru, which became a wealthy country in the Pacific Islands by exporting superphosphate, which tried to ensure for the future by building up financial reserves from those superphosphate exports. But the superphosphate finally ran out, and their reserves were largely wiped out by a financial crisis with some bad investments, and now it's an impoverished nation in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Saudi Arabia may be a much larger impoverished nation in the middle of the Middle East, and that's not a recipe for anybody's happiness anywhere on the planet.
The Saudi faltering economy is mirrored in the unfinished Kingdom Tower, known also as the Jeddah Tower. Initiated by Prince Al-Walid bin Talal's Kingdom Holdings, the construction of the tower began in 2013 and was expected to be completed by 2020. But so far, only a quarter of the tower has been built. The huge, uncompleted building looming over Jeddah is the embarrassing embodiment of an economy which has seen better days and has to keep tight control over the purse strings in the coming years.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today.
We've begun discussing monotheism and the divine attributes in the last few episodes. Shiite scholars believe that God is one, in contrast to other religions such as Christianity.
He's completely immaterial being.
We don't believe that in the Trinity, and that there's three dimensions to God: Holy Spirit, Jesus, and God. We don't believe that he's a physical body. Also, in contrast to other sects in Islam, within Islam, Shiism doesn't believe that God is a physical body. We believe that he has absolute power, he has absolute knowledge. Also, the verses of the Holy Quran in which physical attributes have been ascribed to God, such as having a hand, and so on and so forth, we don't take these literally. We interpret them in a different way, in contrast to other sects within Islam. This is very important, and we're going to be repeating this throughout all of our episodes. It's necessary to make this clear. So even if you see such expressions as the hand of God, it's important not to take this literally, because God doesn't have human-like characteristics such as a physical body.
Today we're going to be looking at a very important problem, and that problem is this, that in the Quran and Hadith, a number of attributes have been mentioned for God, which at first glance seem to be impossible to affirm for him. For example, God in certain places has been mentioned as having a hand or hands. He's been mentioned as having eyes. He's been mentioned as having a face or a side, and so on and so forth. We know that God is not a physical body, and therefore, if we affirm these attributes in the way that we affirm them, or in the meanings that we affirm them for his creatures, it would mean that he has a physical body, which is completely wrong and incorrect. So this caused a problem for our scholars, for the theologians, in that how do we interpret these attributes which have been mentioned in the Quran and the Hadith? One of the theories which has been put forward to explain these attributes is the answer or the theory or explanation presented by a theologian known as Ghazali. If we wanted to explain what he says, we could explain it in the way of an example. For example, if somebody were to say that this kingdom or this government is in the hands of its king, or is in the hands of so-and-so, what would we understand by such a statement? Would we understand that this kingdom and this government or this nation is actually fits in the hands of the person, the physical hand of the person? What would we say? We would clearly say that this statement simply wants to say that this government or this nation or this country is under the authority of such a person, or this person has authority over it, he has power over it. It's possible that the king or the ruler, he might not even have any hands, right? But the statement would nevertheless still be true. Having said this, we can say, Ghazali says that these words that have been used in the Quran and the Hadith have certain apparent meanings, certain primary or apparent meanings, and which are obviously not intended here when they're used for God. It also has, the same words also have certain metaphorical meanings, which a person who's acquainted with the Arabic language would understand right away when he heard such statements being mentioned. For example, if in the Hadith we read that the heart of the believer is between the two fingers of the beneficent God, such a person who's acquainted with the Arabic language would clearly understand the metaphorical meaning of the word being utilized here. And he would know that this word here is used in two meanings. The first is its primary and initial meaning, which is what we mean, which is a reference to the part of the hand that you and I and all of us have. Secondly, it's been borrowed and used as well as in its metaphorical meaning, which is the meaning that's intended here, such as the meaning that was intended when we said that the government is in the hands of its king, or is in the hands of the person governing it. So therefore, no problem arises here, because, first of all, these meanings are used in their apparent meanings. It doesn't require us to alter the meanings of these words. At the same time, it doesn't lead to any interpretation of these attributes in a physical way. Thank you for joining us here today. Joining us here today on The Key. We were looking at God's attributes. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani al-la'in ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Ba'ath al-anbiya'i wal-mursaleen. Thumma salatu wa salam. Ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina wa habibi qulubina wa tabibi nufusina wa shafi'i dhunubina. أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين. The work of Imam al-Hussein was to move towards, in order to guide people as he is guiding individuals on a social scale, to bring the ummah, all those hundreds of thousands at the time, perhaps millions, I'm not sure what the figures were back then, to guide all of them and prevent them from being misled by being given misinformation. There were times that in the name of Islam, brothers and sisters, on the pulpit of the Prophet, in every major city in the Muslim world that extended from North Africa all the way to Central Asia, every major city cursed Amir al-Mu'mineen, salawatullah wa salamuhu alayhi, in the name of Islam. This is what governance can do. And all those people who heard this were poisoned with that misinformation. The world today, the governance of the world today, brothers and sisters, is the cause of all these billions of people getting misinformed about Islam and thinking these different thoughts about what Islam actually is, being misled, being kept busy with materialism, distracted with a fun little thing here and fun little thing there, taking the lives of people and their concerns to be limited to this material realm, and subconsciously being fed this misinformation that God is not there and resurrection is not true. This is being fed. People are being brainwashed. Unfortunately, a lot of us have been brainwashed by this global governance into thinking that when Muslims are teaching their children the fact that God exists and He is in charge and He's the only God and no one else is in charge, they think that this is brainwashing. And they say in order for it not to be brainwashing, you need to provide reasons. And for people in every line of every science book to use language and wording that makes people think of this world in a way where every molecule, every subatomic particle is its own being that somehow haphazardly, with some coincidence, has ended up where it is, and this entire system is functioning. This is being fed to people. They're being brainwashed. This is not being seen. People are being brainwashed against Islam. People are being brainwashed against Muslims. People are being brainwashed against what Islam is. It's the American and the Western global, you've heard this language, the global, the New World Order after the World War, the Second World War as they called it, the International War, these powers that were the most powerful nations or governments. At the time, they fought each other, and a couple of them won over the others, and then they started fighting in the Cold War, and then one superpower. This world order is governance. It is this world order that forms public opinion. The mainstream media and social media. Social media is a tool at their disposal. YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, all of these forms of social media and whatever else is created is under their control. When they want, they will use Facebook to get people to come and participate in the elections. You've seen that. They encourage every person to come and participate on this phony elections in this country. When it comes to the elections in other countries, particularly in the Islamic Republic, the same Facebook is used to encourage people not to go, to tell people that that is not a democracy, that your votes do not count, that this is all a game. Social media is a tool at their disposal. They created the second fabricated Egyptian revolution. It wasn't a real revolution. It wasn't what the people wanted. People didn't want another dictator. That's exactly what Assisi is. Who brought those people to the street? Well, the people who are in charge of Facebook, and they know how to do it. Well, social media, these different, Facebook is one example. People are being brainwashed by this world order, this global governance. People are being told. CNN goes into these countries, BBC goes into these countries, Fox and all these different news outlets, and then they create these other ones for other languages. There is a list of Farsi outlets that have been created to manipulate Farsi-speaking people. There are a list of outlets that have been created in Arabic, whether it's directly by these people or by governments that are completely under their control, like the Saudi government, like the Qatari government, like the Emirati government. These governments are... Al Jazeera is not a Muslim outlet speaking based on the principles of Islam. It has nothing to do with that. It's another version of Western media in the Arabic language, though, or the English language. They've created both of those. They brainwash people. They brainwash people. They brainwash Muslims. That's what they're doing. If the world is to be guided in the direction of Allah, if all of these masses are to be guided in the direction of Allah to receive actual information, not misinformation in the form of information, then the world order has got to be the world order of Allah, led by the Imam, appointed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's what the Imams were working towards. That's what Imam al-Husayn was working towards. He wasn't only looking even at that government, the regions that the Muslim government at the time was governing. Imam al-Husayn, based on the teachings of Islam, of the Quran, they were supposed to make sure that any tyranny, any other government which is a tyranny, is prevented from misinforming their people, mistreating their people, causing injustice, intellectual injustice.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Azim Alim Halim Hakim Mateen Ghafur Shakur Wadud Qayyum Rauf Sabur Majid. صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
Sanctions are a topic that often go underreported. They're seen by most people as being some kind of tame, mild alternative to war. But they're just as destructive as war, if not more. They're a modern equivalent of siege warfare, just like when armies would surround a city, cutting off its food supplies and isolating the inhabitants until they either surrendered or died of malnutrition and disease. Today, I want to talk about two countries, Venezuela and Syria, that are subject to some of the worst sanctions, although they're not the only ones. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The United States has been trying to topple the governments of Venezuela and Syria for a while now. Independent socialist countries who refuse to serve the financial and geopolitical interests of the United States usually do end up being couped, invaded, or sanctioned, sometimes all three. After all, this isn't something new. There isn't a country in Central or Latin America that the United States hasn't meddled in. We've seen the United States overthrow the democratically elected president of Guatemala in 1954. We saw a CIA-backed coup in Chile in 1973. The United States was financing death squads in Nicaragua and El Salvador in the 1980s, bombing Grenada in 1983, and much more. It's quite an extensive list. And it's important, of course, to underline this and point out the recent history, just so that there's no illusions of what's going on here. The United States and their partners are interested in regime change and will do so for economic reasons, as they have done so in the past. Again, it's no coincidence that Venezuela, besides being an anti-imperialist socialist nation, also happens to sit on the world's largest reserves of oil. Now, sanctions against Venezuela date back to the days of the Bush regime. Every U.S. president since has taken steps to expand the embargo on Venezuela. In 2014 and 2015, Barack Obama imposed further sanctions on Venezuela, freezing assets and issuing travel bans. Then when Donald Trump took over as president, he imposed even more sanctions as part of his maximum pressure campaign. In January 2019, Trump targeted Venezuela's oil sector. The oil embargo included the Trump administration blocking sales from Venezuela's state-owned oil company, PDVSA, and then seizing its U.S. subsidiary, Citgo, which is worth billions. Remember, Venezuela relies heavily on its exports of oil for that stream of revenue, and Trump also proceeded to target its financial sector in March 2019 and its defense and security sector in May 2019. Now, although the United States claims it imposes sanctions to punish certain government officials and ministers for, you know, alleged human rights abuses and cracking down on protesters, something the United States has no problem doing on its own citizens, the United States isn't acting as some kind of benevolent moral arbiter. It wants to replace the Venezuelan government with someone more favorable to the interests of Washington, D.C., which is why the United States has been propping up the former leader of the National Assembly in Venezuela, Juan Guaido. This guy, who most Venezuelans haven't even heard of, is essentially their stooge. He's a puppet that they want to put in place in order to further their political and economic interests. As per usual, the European Union followed the lead of the United States and also imposed sanctions on Venezuela and also proceeded to push Juan Guaido as the supposed interim president of Venezuela. Now, whatever issues Venezuela had internally, these sanctions have only served to exacerbate them and as a result have spurred on one of the worst displacement crises in the world. According to the United Nations, worldwide, there are over 5 million Venezuelan refugees and migrants, and over 800,000 asylum seekers, and 2.5 million living under other legal forms of stay in the Americas. Sanctions make life hell for the people living there, and this is precisely why so many people are fleeing. The poverty rate has reached record levels and plunged the Venezuelan people into unimaginably cruel conditions. Since Venezuela's economy is so heavily dependent on oil, by blocking Venezuela from selling its oil and stealing its companies, the U.S. is essentially cutting off funding for social services and government infrastructure. They know this, and they do this anyway, hoping that the people will rise up and overthrow their government. To further examine the harsh realities of economic sanctions, I'm joined by Alina Duhan. She is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, or sanctions. She's also a professor of international law at the Belarusian State University, and she just returned recently from Venezuela. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the program, Professor. It's good to have you.
It's a pleasure for me.
I wanted to ask you if you could maybe further explain the mechanism of how these sanctions can end up being so devastating for the local currency of another country and freezing the assets as well and so forth. And also how that ties into Syria, because the Syrian pound is also experiencing this hyperinflation, specifically after the implementation of the Caesar Act sanctions in June 2020.
The economic situation as well as hyperinflation started to develop in Venezuela as soon as the oil prices started to drop, starting from 2013. So there was a serious economic decrease. And the hyperinflation has already started at that point. When we speak about Syria, the Syrian economy has already been devastated by years of conflict over the years. So we need to take into account that situation was already far from good one before sanctions have been imposed. Countries, for example, Venezuela can't sell oil anymore. If we compare with 2015 and 2016, when sanctions started to be imposed, the revenue of Venezuela from selling oil dropped from 100% to 1%. So they started to get only 1% of the money they used to get because of selling oil. The mining sector of Venezuela has also been listed, and therefore they can't sell anything, can't export anything they used to get from the mining sector as well. That's why the income has dropped even further. That the assets Venezuela had in the banks of the United States, United Kingdom, and Portugal, which upon different assessments were between $5 and $6 billion, have been frozen. The country is losing income and can't pay to social services. And as a result, a lot of social projects which used to be supported by the government, in particular, the government used to provide 2 meals per day at schools. So children were fed at schools. Now it's limited to 1, and this 1 is usually very small. It doesn't contain protein. So children do not eat at schools anymore.
And how would you describe the medical and public health infrastructure in Venezuela at the moment? How much have these institutions been further imperiled, generally speaking, by these sanctions?
Before 2016, the government used to provide the full coverage of medical expenses to every citizen of Venezuela. I was visiting the cardiological child hospital. Traditionally, this hospital was doing 1,500 surgeries, heart surgeries for children per year. Last year, this hospital was only able to do 160 surgeries. So it basically means that more than 1,300 children were not able to get this surgery. I was visiting the hospitals both in Caracas and outside of Caracas. And I have been reported that in some of them, they can't even do, for example, the simple blood test because all the centrifuges are already broken. The majority of hospitals demonstrate that about 80% of equipment is already broken because it's impossible to buy spare parts for the equipment. And traditionally, Venezuela was buying the equipment either from the United States or from Europe. And that's a really serious problem.
You know, when the United States announced sanctions, they usually say that they're going to make an exception for humanitarian aid, for relief agencies. Does that actually translate into reality?
In practice, unfortunately, the majority of these humanitarian exceptions doesn't work. First of all, the procedure to get a permission to deliver humanitarian aid is lengthy and costly. That means that only huge humanitarian organizations which have a necessary legal department can be involved into that. A small one can't even effort doing that. Secondly, even if there is a possibility to get a humanitarian exceptions, it still doesn't mean that a company will be able to buy humanitarian goods because of the fear of secondary sanctions. So the majority of banks and the majority of companies outside of the countries will be scared to be involved into transactions. That if you look, for example, at the guidances which have been developed by the European Union as concerned the delivery of humanitarian aid, the burden of proof of the initial humanitarian purpose is laying on humanitarian actors. So the humanitarian organizations face the following situation. They need to find the donors. They need to find a way to get an exception. They need to prove that these goods will only be used for humanitarian purposes, and they will be responsible if anything will happen. That's why they prefer not to be involved that much in this sphere. And that's why I delivered the guidance on delivery of humanitarian aid at the end of 2020. And I called for some steps to be taken to improve situation with humanitarian exception. But the last point, which is also important, is that usually, even if it's possible to get humanitarian exception, these humanitarian exceptions are only referring to medical goods and to food. It's impossible to get a humanitarian exception to anything else. There are enormous problems, for example, to get humanitarian exceptions for something which could be considered as a dual-use goods. In Venezuela, there are serious problems with spare parts for the medical equipment, spare parts for water, electricity supply, as well as industry responsible for agriculture. And buying this equipment and buying these spare parts is never considered to fall under humanitarian exceptions.
Alina Duhan, thank you so much for your time. It's a pleasure speaking with you, Professor.
It was a pleasure for me. Thank you for interest.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Similarly to Venezuela, Syria has also been on the receiving end of brutal sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union, all done in the aim of toppling the Syrian government and effectuating regime change. Syria has undergone the world's worst refugee crisis in modern history. Half of Syria's population has been displaced by this war, even members of my own family. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, more than 6.6 million Syrians have been forced to flee their homes since 2011, and another 6.7 million people remain displaced inside the country. And on top of all that suffering, the European Union and the United States don't stop there. It's not enough that Western powers have funded armed groups inside Syria to sow chaos, or that Israel helped Al-Qaeda fighters because it suited them to see Syria fall. No, on top of all that, they go ahead and tighten the noose even further on the Syrian people. It's despicable. In June 2020, the Trump regime implemented the Caesar Act. These sanctions are the most severe and extensive sanctions Syria has ever faced, despite having been under sanctions for decades. Right now in Syria, people are queuing up in bread lines. Bread lines in a country that used to grow its own wheat and have enough wheat left over to export to other countries. People now have to wait hours just to get a little bit of bread that isn't even enough to properly feed a family. This wasn't a thing before the war. This was unheard of. People have drawn comparisons between what's happening now and the way hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were viciously starved to death by sanctions in the 1990s. Before the war on Syria started in 2011, one US dollar was equal to 47 Syrian pounds. Now, $1 is equal to 4,000 Syrian pounds on the black market. This devaluation of the currency and hyperinflation brought on by the war and exacerbated by the Caesar sanctions has completely shattered Syria's economy. And of course, given that Lebanon and Syria's economies are inextricably intertwined, and Lebanon is going through its own economic crisis, that doesn't do much to help either. Not only is the United States isolating Syria from the world and cutting off its resources, it's also holding them hostage and occupying Syria's oil fields in the northeast and the breadbasket region where its crops are grown. Last year, Senator Lindsey Graham gleefully exclaimed his approval of the fact that the U.S. had signed a deal with the Kurdish-led SDF to steal Syria's oil, and even gloated about these sadistic Caesar Act sanctions, asking like some bloodthirsty monster whether more were coming.
The Caesars Act, thank you for using it quickly and in a holding Assad's son accountable is a great first step in what I think will be a long journey to punish this regime. Is more coming?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Great job.
According to the latest report from the World Food Program, a record 12.4 million Syrians, that's nearly 60% of the population, are now food insecure. In just over 1 year, an additional 4.5 million Syrians have become food insecure. Sean O'Brien, the World Food Program's representative and country director in Syria, said that the, quote, situation has never been worse. Basic foods to feed a family for a month, bread, rice, lentils, and oil and sugar, now cost at least 120,000 Syrian pounds, which far exceeds the average salaries. Over the last year, food prices across Syria have soared, and the price of basic items has increased by 236%, just as the value of the Syrian pound has plummeted. On average, the price of oil has increased from 1,000 Syrian pounds in January 2020 to 5,000 Syrian pounds in January 2021. UN Special Rapporteur Alina Duhan once again called on the United States to remove unilateral sanctions on Syria, saying, quote, the sanctions violate the human rights of the Syrian people, whose country has been destroyed by almost 10 years of ongoing conflict. The broad sweep of the United States sanctions law that went into effect in June could target any foreigner helping in reconstruction of the devastated country and even employees of foreign companies and humanitarian operators helping rebuild Syria. To talk more about these brutal Caesar Act sanctions that are gripping the Syrian population, journalist Vanessa Bealey joins me from Damascus. Vanessa, thank you for taking the time. I know you don't have a lot of electricity at the moment, ironically, because of the sanctions. How are you doing?
I love how they always term, when I say they, of course, I'm talking about the U.S. coalition, the U.S., U.K., EU, who are imposing these sanctions on the Syrian people. Let's make this really clear. You know, sanctions never target what our governments tell you that they are targeting. They target the people, some of the poorest and some of the most destabilized, traumatized people who have already gone through a 10-year war. You know, the first point I have to make is that Al-Qaeda are not under sanctions. The SDF are not under sanctions. ISIS are not under sanctions inside Syria, right? Let's make that really clear. Humanitarian aid that comes into Bab al-Hawa in Idlib on the border with Turkey is being taken by Al-Qaeda and is being used as part of their mafia operation to provide them with revenue. Okay, so let's make this really clear. Sanctions don't apply to the terrorist and extremist groups and the proxies of the U.S. coalition. They only apply to those people that are living under the protection of the Syrian state and its allies by choice. And you have to remember that the sanctions here are on top of policies like the burning of crops, the occupation of oil resources and the theft of those oil resources. America doesn't want the oil. It wants to deprive the Syrian people of that oil and to provide revenue for its proxies, in this case, or the Kurdish separatists.
So how are people actually holding up without these commodities and, you know, electricity and gas? Because you see pictures of people lining up for bread now. I've heard stories of people putting on layers of clothes just to keep warm. So how are people managing without these necessities?
The U.S. occupation of the oil means that the refineries under the protection of the Syrian government are not receiving oil supplies. So the electrical power stations are not running efficiently. There is no gas for heating. There's no oil for heating. Yesterday, in fact, I drove past a queue of around 15 kilometers for fuel for cars, right? And this has been the situation since I've been here, which is almost 2 years now. Electricity-wise, we're on 4 hours off, 2 hours on. So effectively, every day, I only really get 6 working hours of electricity, as I call it. In the next suburb, they're lucky if they get 1 hour per day.
Can you maybe describe how much prices have gone up and how much everything has gotten more expensive? Because, you know, you've spent a couple of years in Syria, so, I mean, you've actually known how it was before, even though that was, of course, still during wartime, but still.
Well, I mean, people are always saying to me, for example, a kilo of chicken previously would have been less than 1,000 Syrian pounds. Right now, with inflation and with the scarcity of food, it's more than 10,000 a kilo. So prices have gone up 10 times. People are still earning, let's say, a Syrian Arab Army soldier is still on a salary of around $50, right? But they're expected to pay 10 times what they were paying before for food, for heating, for gas. I mean, gas now, I think when I first came, it was around 15,000 Syrian pounds for a gas canister. It's now 35,000, 40,000. And you have to queue to get it.
So, Vanessa, what are your thoughts on the mainstream media, especially in the West, how they're reporting on the sanctions or perhaps not reporting?
And it's astounding to me how Western media spins this story. You know, they talk about it all being down to the Assad regime. But in reality, the reason there are bread queues, you know, the Syrian government has maintained its provision of bread throughout the 10 years of this war, despite all of the hardships, the sanctions, the terrorist attacks, etc. And now it can't. But why? Because as we've mentioned, the burning of the crops during the summer across the country, the burning of forestry, the burning of cotton crops, the burning of olive plantations, right? And right now, the SDF, the Kurdish Contras, are stealing the wheat and barley still right now, and they're trading it cross-border, just as they're doing with the oil. And by the way, the oil is providing revenue not only for the SDF, but the SDF are then sending it to Al-Qaeda in Idlib for processing.
How would you describe the morale? How do you see the Syrian people? Are they tolerating it? Are they being resilient? How's the general psychology? And, you know, how are they holding up, given that they've gone through so much, so many years of war, and now on top of it, sanctions?
Look, Syrian people, as you know, are incredibly resourceful, incredibly resilient, incredibly steadfast. And as they always do, they're making the best of it. But they're exhausted. You know, as I said before, Syria right now should be rebuilding. For me, I think the most heartbreaking thing is the medical sector. I mean, I had a meeting with the deputy health minister last week, and chronic illnesses they're just not able to cope with because the machinery and equipment and analysis equipment that they need is breaking down. They can't get spare parts because European countries are not allowed to deal with them. And, you know, the saddest thing, there are doctors. Most of these doctors, Syrian doctors, have trained in the EU. So they have contacts and they have established collaboration in the EU. But they're not allowed to collaborate under the sanctions, even for the medical sector, even for kids that have cancer. You know, this is the insanity that people need to understand. There is nothing humanitarian or protective about sanctions. It is all about destruction. It is all about killing people. Really, sanctions kill people. That's what we need to kind of get into our heads.
According to the latest figures from the United Nations Population